This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the goals of healthcare reform is to control ballooning healthcare costs. My guest, Maggie Mahar, is the author of the 2006 book, Money-Driven Medicine, The Real Reason Healthcare Costs So Much, which has just been adapted into a film by Alex Gibney, who also made the documentaries Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, and the Academy Award-winning Taxi to the Dark Side. The film Money-Driven Medicine will soon be available on DVD. Mahar is a healthcare fellow at the Century Foundation, where she writes the blog HealthBeat. She's a former financial journalist. Mahar says we need to reform the system because in a decade, healthcare costs will double where they are now, and studies show that $1 in $3 spent on healthcare is wasted on redundant or ineffective treatments. Maggie Mahar, welcome to Fresh Air. One of your main concerns is that we need to eliminate unnecessary and ineffective treatments.
That's right. But that has to be done very carefully. I mean, this is not fat that's hanging out on the edges of the steak where you can see it. This is fat that's marbled through the meat. So we need to take a scalpel and very carefully excise that waste. And that's why we need a panel of physicians, healthcare experts, looking at the evidence. That's what President Obama has proposed, having an independent, bipartisan panel of doctors and other medical experts that is shielded from Congress and lobbyists to a large degree, that is simply looking at the medical evidence and making decisions about which are the most effective treatments for patients who fit a particular medical profile, and then issuing guidelines, not rules, but guidelines that will help doctors and steer them and patients toward the most effective treatments.
In the book, in your book, You write that market forces have splintered the healthcare system and that it's now this Hobbesian marketplace where it's a war of all against all, and it's pitting the healthcare industry's players against one another. Hospital versus hospital, doctor versus doctor, hospital versus insurer, insurer versus hospital, insurer versus drug maker versus drug maker. That's making it more expensive. I mean, market forces are supposed to keep prices down through competition. You're saying it's making it more expensive?
That's right. In healthcare, market forces don't bring prices down. We've seen that everything becomes more expensive every year, drugs, hospital stays. In other markets, the consumer has the power to bring prices down as producers compete with each other. But it's because a consumer can say, you know, that laptop is a little expensive. I'm going to wait until a competitor, a rival, comes out with a less expensive laptop that will meet my needs. When you're sick, you can't say, I'll wait until a less expensive cancer drug comes out. 80% of our healthcare dollars are spent on patients who are seriously ill, suffering from chronic diseases like cancer. They don't have the choice to wait. They need what they need at that moment. And so they can't help bring prices down by comparison shopping, by putting off the purchase, by any of those things. They essentially have to take whatever it is that the doctor or the hospital tells them that they need at that time.
So what kind of systemic change do you think we need to change this competitive relationship to a collaborative relationship?
Recently, I attended a conference sponsored by the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and Dartmouth. And at that conference, they looked at 10 communities where healthcare spending is low and quality of care is very high. And these are diverse communities, ranging from Sacramento to Tallahassee, Florida. These are communities, what they have in common is in each of these communities, doctors and hospitals have gotten together and agreed to collaborate. In many cases, they've agreed also to get away from fee-for-service payments and instead they accept what are called bundled payments, where the hospital and all the doctors involved in an episode of care receive a lump sum that usually goes to the hospital and then is divided up among them. This means that they have a motivation to work with each other. The House legislation has many suggestions for reforming the way Medicare pays for care and suggestions for how Medicare can provide incentives that would change the way doctors and hospitals deliver care so that it would be more patient-centered, more cooperative, less competitive.
Do you think that there are perverse incentives in the system right now?
Definitely. The biggest one is paying fee-for-service, because when you pay fee-for-service, you're telling the doctor, we want you to do more. The more you do, the more we'll pay you. We're going to pay you for the quantity of work you do. We're paying you for volume. We're paying you piecework as if you were a factory worker. What we should be doing is paying doctors for the quality of work they're doing, for good outcomes. We have more than two decades of research from Dartmouth showing that one out of three healthcare dollars is wasted doing more. More aggressive care, more intensive care, more tests, more treatments does not lead to better outcomes. Often outcomes are worse because a patient is being overtreated, and that means he's being exposed to treatments that provide no benefit, yet every treatment has some risk, so he's being exposed to risks without benefit.
When I go to my doctors, I always feel like they look so rushed and harried, and I assume that that's because there's pressure on them by insurance companies or their institutions to see a lot of patients. I don't get the feeling like it's that they want to do more procedures so that they can personally make more money. Are there pressures on them from either the institution they work for or the health insurance company to see as many patients as possible?
Certainly not from the health insurance company. The health insurance company would rather they did less because then the health insurance company would owe them less. Some institutions, perhaps, but basically this is an internal pressure. As doctors will tell you very honestly, I have to see a patient every 15 minutes or I can't keep the lights on. I can't keep my practice afloat. The only way I can make it financially is if I see a patient every 15 minutes. I hate this. I wish this weren't the case, but that's the way it is. Now, in terms of primary care, that's because we don't pay enough for primary care. The fees that we pay primary care doctors are very low. Many primary care doctors make $110,000, $115,000 a year. If they have recently graduated from medical school, they may have $250,000 in debt. So they don't want to have to churn patients, but they have no choice if they're going to stay financially afloat.
So there's a big gap now between what primary care doctors earn and what specialists earn?
Yes, absolutely. Specialists often earn 3, 4, 5, 6 times as much as primary care doctors. Now, they've gone to school longer, so they should be – it makes sense that they'd be earning some more, but does it really make sense that they would earn 4 or 5 times as much every year over the course of a 30-year career? Probably not. One thing that the House legislation – is doing is, first of all, it calls for raising primary care fees by at least 5% and by 10% in regions where there's a shortage of primary care doctors. That would also apply to geriatricians and pediatricians under the public sector plan. So these are increases in fees under Medicare First and under the public sector plan. In addition, the House legislation gives Medicare the freedom to set fees with an eye to benefit to patients. Right now, fees for specialists are set with an eye to what it costs the specialist to provide the treatment. Nowhere in the equation does anyone ask how much does a patient benefit. It's all about how much it costs the doctor. The new legislation would let Medicare begin to set fees more with an eye to benefit for patients. That means that some specialist fees for certain treatments that we know are only marginally effective might go down. At the same time, it's definite that fees for primary care would be going up. And in addition to raising the fees, the House legislation calls for loan forgiveness for medical students who choose to become primary care doctors. Right now, many med students feel they can't afford to go into primary care. It just doesn't pay well enough.
As we look to reform the healthcare system in the United States, what are some of the things you think we can learn from the successes and failures of Medicare?
Good question. Well, the failures of Medicare is that it is spending millions, billions of dollars on ineffective and unnecessary treatments because it hasn't sorted out and looked at the comparative effectiveness of various treatments. So that's something that needs to be reformed and changed about Medicare, and that's something that the current administration already is planning on doing. Successes of Medicare, I think, is that it's a consistent program that provides equal care for everyone. It doesn't matter how much you put into the system. It doesn't matter whether you're wealthy or poor. everyone gets the same quality and amount of care. And that, I think, is terribly important. And we want a health care reform system that provides equal care for all at the same price. And that's something that is going to happen under the legislation, which says that private insurers will no longer be able to charge you more if you have a pre-existing condition. And they won't be able to take your insurance away because they discover a pre-existing condition. Everyone in a given community will pay the same amount, except private insurers will be allowed to charge older people up to twice as much as they charge younger people. This, I think, is very unfortunate.
And what you're saying is that younger people have to pay to make the larger system work. So if only sick
people
are buying insurance, it's going to be incredibly unaffordable.
Yeah, well, I mean, younger people will also be under a mandate to buy insurance. The question is whether they pay less for the insurance than older people. Mm-hmm. If younger people pay less, then older people have to pay more or there won't be enough money in the pool. But I think that the Obama administration realizes that young people in this country, many of them are not happy about the mandate, about the idea that they're going to have to buy insurance. And in order to soften the blow, the administration and congressional Democrats are saying, you do have to buy insurance, but since you're young and healthy, you don't have to pay as much for it.
Let's take a look at insurance companies. A lot of people feel like they're suffering under the burden of enormous health care costs, even if they have insurance. How are the insurance companies doing?
They're not doing very well either, because the cost of health care has been spiraling. In recent years, private insurance companies have been paying out more and more each year for health care. Reimbursements have been going up 8% a year, year after year. That means insurance companies are paying out 8% more each year to doctors and hospitals. They've been raising premiums at a very rapid rate as well, trying to pass those costs along, but they've just about kept up with rising costs. That's why your premiums have been spiraling. The insurer's administrative costs have not gone up. Their profits, in many cases, have not been very good. The insurers who've done well are the insurers who offer Medicare Advantage, because the Bush administration decided that if insurers would offer Medicare, this is for-profit private insurers, we would pay them 13% more than Medicare spends to treat the same patients. So we gave them a bonus, really corporate welfare, and that has helped many insurers be profitable in recent years. However, under the current health reform legislation, those Medicare Advantage bonuses are going to be cut, and insurers are going to be in trouble. Insurers are going to have to become more efficient in order to survive.
What will that likely mean for us, the patients?
It should actually mean good things if insurers are wise. Insurers are going to be forced to compete with the public sector option. And insurers are going to be told you can no longer cherry pick, you can no longer avoid sick patients and only insure healthy people. So that means insurers are going to have to pay more attention to the quality of care that they are providing. That means they're going to have to try to get the very best hospital and doctor networks together and provide some sort of bonuses or encouragement for those doctors and hospitals to collaborate, to focus on patient-centered medicine, to focus on quality of care. Up until now, insurers have largely focused on keeping their costs down and not so much on encouraging the highest quality care from their providers. But that was going to have to be their focus if they want to compete with the public sector option and survive.
The word choice is a word you hear coming up a lot. People want choice. They want to be able to choose their doctors. And I'm wondering what choice means to you, and if you think there are choices that as the system is reformed, we're going to have to give up.
I think that people are unnecessarily fearful, partially because they don't understand that the health care they have now is not very good. The U.S. does not have the best health care in the world. And medical researchers and doctors will tell you this. If you read in medical journals, you'll see studies done by American doctors comparing outcomes for various diseases. Outcomes are often not the best in the U.S. In terms of managing chronic diseases, we rank quite low. So no one wants to believe this because people want to feel, well, I can trust my doctor and I know my doctor is the best and what he's doing is the very best possible thing he could do for me. To think anything else is scary. So when people worry about losing something, they're worrying about losing something in the context of thinking that what they have now is better than it really is. Secondly, if we didn't reform the system, you have to remember what the president said in a recent press conference, which is the system we have now is a plan where costs are going to double in the next 10 years. And many of you who now have insurance will find yourself uninsured, alone in a market where you have to somehow or other come up with the money to pay for insurance that is twice as costly as it is today. That's the alternative to health care reform. So whatever an individual may feel he's giving up, A, it probably won't be something that actually helps him, and B, the alternative, not reforming health care, is catastrophic.
I think a lot of people are worried that they won't be able to afford to buy their own insurance in the new system after the legislation has passed, and that the public option will be an inferior plan, and that if they take the public option, they won't get the kind of health care that they want. Are you concerned about that?
Not at all. The public option will be very similar to Medicare. Most people who have Medicare are very happy with most of the coverage. It doesn't include long-term care, and this troubles people. But on the whole, if you look at satisfaction and you poll people, what we found is that people with Medicare are much happier than people with employer-based private insurance. The public sector option, if you actually read the House bill, the 1,018-page House bill, which I have read, you find that the public sector option covers virtually everything that you can think of, including mental health care, including dental care and vision care for children. It also stipulates that there be no copays for primary care, which means people won't put off going for primary care. And it really covers, you know, hospitalization, doctor care, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a full menu, a very comprehensive coverage. In terms of being able to afford the public sector option or private insurance, the subsidies are also very generous. The subsidies cover people up to four times the poverty level. So the subsidies will be available to families earning up to about $88,000 a year. The statistical middle class is clustered around people earning $60,000 for a household a year. So we're talking about offering some subsidy to most of the middle class and a tiny bit of the upper middle class as well. You know, this will be affordable. Certainly it will cost something. And people may find themselves spending as much as 10% of their income, their gross income, on health insurance. For people who now have employer-based insurance, with their employer paying typically 75% of the cost if you're an upper-income employee, those people may find that they're paying more for insurance if they decide to give up their employer-based insurance, or if their employer decides to drop the insurance.
If you had your way,
right,
what kind of system would you create? Would it be a single-payer system? Would it be a whole lot of options like is being proposed now? Obviously, you don't want to keep the system the way it is. You've made that very clear.
Right. If I were Tsarina, this is what I would do. I would create a hybrid system, much like the system that the Obama administration is trying to create, where you have both public sector insurance and the option of private sector insurance. I would like to see that private sector insurance be nonprofit insurance. In other words, insurance companies that don't have to worry about generating a profit, that don't have to try to juggle priorities. Should I try to please my shareholders or should I try to please my customers? We have some very good nonprofit insurers in this country. Kaiser Permanente in Northern California is excellent. Geisinger is excellent. I would like to see them in the mix along with a government insurance program. I'd like to see everyone paying the same percentage of their income into the pool to help pay for health insurance for all of us. Why don't I want a single-payer plan? First of all, it would be enormously difficult to persuade everyone in this country who has employer-based insurance to give it up and go into an unknown government plan. Secondly, and maybe even more importantly, a government plan, if that was all we had, depending on the politics of the government, could take away things that many of us feel are necessary to health care. It could become very stingy. It could decide only to cover certain people. It could decide to penalize people who were fat or who were had other, you know, problems, mental health problems, etc. And that's why I would always want an escape hatch. I'd always want alternatives to the public sector plan and for Americans to be free to choose which plan they wanted.
Well, Maggie Mahar, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Maggie Mahar is the author of Money Driven Medicine, which has just been adapted into a film that will soon be available on DVD. She's a healthcare fellow at the Century Foundation, where she writes the blog HealthBeat. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A verbal gaffe that unintentionally leads the British to join the U.S. in planning a war against a country in the Middle East. Gaffes and spin and ideological political agendas that lead to war are the subject of the political satire In the Loop. The war in the film is against an unnamed country in the Middle East, but the film makes intentional parallels to the lead-up to the war in Iraq. My guest is the writer and director of the film, Armando Iannucci. The main characters in the film are adapted from his BBC series, The Thick of It. Early in the film, the British Minister for International Development is asked by a journalist about the possibility of war. He responds that war is unforeseeable, which is incorrectly interpreted as inevitable, which is not what the official government position is. This leads to a series of disastrous misunderstandings in England and in the U.S., where the minister is sent to meet with other mid-level officials. Here's a scene right after that unforeseeable gaffe. The minister, played by Tom Hollander, is in hot water because of the gaffe. Things get even worse when he runs into a pack of reporters.
Hello there. Hi.
So is war unforeseeable, Minister?
Look, all sorts of things that are actually very likely are also unforeseeable. For the plane in the fog, the mountain is unforeseeable, but then it is suddenly very real and inevitable.
Right.
Is this your opinion, or is this the government position?
The mountain in the metaphor is a completely hypothetical mountain that could represent anything.
Sorry, Minister, I'm unclear.
Yeah. What I'm saying is that to walk the road of peace, sometimes we need to be ready to climb the mountain of conflict. Thank you so much.
You'd be climbing the mountain alone, Minister.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. That's it, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Armando Iannucci, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, since spin is so important in your movie and political language and evasive political language, were you listening very closely during the lead-up to the Iraq war, both because you wanted to know what was going to happen, but also just to hear the words that the politicians were using to say or hide what their intentions were?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was listening very intently, principally because I was frustrated by the fact that you could clearly see there was a headlong, unstoppable rush towards war, coupled with all these public statements that every avenue was being explored, every possible attempt to defuse the situation was being explored. And so there was this conflict between what was clearly happening and what we were being told was happening. And the whole rush towards war was full of these illogicalities, these arguments that said, for example, you know, Saddam would attack us if we invaded him. Therefore, we have to invade him to stop him using the weapons that he's going to use on us once we invade him. It's a sort of an abuse of argument and an abuse of language. And Rumsfeld was very, very famous for it. You know, we all remember his "there are no known knowns and known unknowns," and, you know, his very enigmatic press conferences.
What's one or two of the favorite lines you and your writers came up with for your movie?
Well, Malcolm, once the minister says war is unforeseeable, Malcolm Tucker, the government's chief spin doctor, then rings around all the press and tries to roll back from that. And he does. There is a shot of him walking out of number 10 Downing Street on the phone to a journalist saying, "You may have heard him say that, but he did not say it." which I quite like. It's that truth is really a very relative thing. Truth is what you make it, that I think sort of underpins the comedy and the thinking behind the film, really.
I think I have a scene that will illustrate that I'd like to play. And this is a scene from early in the film where the head of a secret war committee is meeting with his aide. And the head of the secret war committee's name is Linton Barwich. Tell us a little bit about this character before we hear the scene.
Linton Barwich is he's the Under Secretary of State in charge of policy at the State Department, and he is fundamentally an amalgam of all the intellectually driven neocons like Paul Wolfowitz and John Bolton and Rumsfeld, there is a sort of an arrogance about their belief in their intellectual rightness that overrides everything else. And talking to people who worked with them, I arrived at this impression that they were sort of bullies, but they were intellectual bullies, and their bullying took the form of just deciding that not to connect with anyone who disagreed with them.
So here's a neocon Linton Barwich meeting with his aide who has just gotten back from London.
Now, what else happened in London?
Generally positive. Two glitches.
Really, what?
Karen flagged a report by one of her staffers.
Really?
She's obviously trying to use it as some kind of roadblock. It's called Quip-Pip.
Quip what?
Quip-Pip.
What is it, a report on bird calls? What does it even stand for?
I can't recall, but it's factish. Intel for and against intervention.
We have all the facts on this we need. We don't need any more facts. In the land of truth, my friend, the man with one fact is the king. All right, you said there was something else. What is that?
In the meeting with the Foreign Office, the committee was accidentally and briefly alluded to.
Which committee?
The war committee, sir.
All right. Karen is not to know about this, huh? She is an excitable, yapping she-dog. All right, we've got to get a hold of those minutes. I have to correct the record.
We can do that?
Yes, we can. Those minutes are an aide memoir for us. They should not be a reductive record of what happened to have been said, but they should be a more full record of what was intended to have been said. I think that's the more accurate version, don't you?
Sir.
Right.
I really like that the minute should be a memoir for us.
Yes.
Of what
yes.
we intended to say.
And so it's not that thing of, like, you know, the truth is what you make it. And a lot of when I came out to research the film and spoke to people in the CIA and the Pentagon and so on, they were all saying that the evidence that was being presented to the neocons was evidence that they wanted to hear. You know, there was already a sort of selective filtering going on because nobody wanted to lose their job. And when they were actually given evidence that said there are no weapons of mass destruction, rather than the neocons saying, oh, well, let's call the whole thing off, their attitude was, well, that must mean they're hiding them. So it's that notion that they've made their conclusion in advance, and then you go out and you find knowledge that will back up that conclusion rather than the other way around.
One of the dynamics in the film is that when the British political aides come to the United States to meet with American leaders there, they're seen as relatively inconsequential.
Oh, absolutely. And they go out to Washington feeling that they are quite important and are going to be feted and are going to have a major say. And then they turn out to be, the phrase they use is room meat in the room, just numbers, bulk for the different factions that want them out there. And that's based on two things, actually. That's based on what actually happened when Blair and his entourage came out to Washington. Blair thought he was coming out to try and stop George Bush going to war. But in fact, it was Blair's presence in America and his presence standing beside George Bush that actually encouraged the pro-war faction to go to war. And so Blair was really there as a number. And also, they from all accounts, they got a little bit giddy. They kind of lost their cool and got slightly kind of excited being in the White House and being in the Oval Room and being on the international stage and being considered public figures. And I reminded the UK cast when we were shooting these scenes, I said, try and remember what it was like the first time you went out to Hollywood. You went out to LA and you had all sorts of meetings and all sorts of agents came and talked to you and said how great you were and how you thought it was all going to change. And then after your stay in Hollywood for, what, 3 or 4 days, you went home empty-handed with nothing and how you'd felt used and soiled. And yet when you got home, how you had returned to a very drab, grey, rainy London and were already pining for those hot, sunny days in LA when people were telling you how great you were.
Well, it sounds like this happened to you.
Well, it did, actually. There was the film is a sort of an offshoot of a TV show I do with the BBC called The Thick of It, which is set in a government ministry in London. And there was an attempt to make they made an American pilot of it for ABC, set in Congress. And I came out to LA and it was my first trip out and, you know, I was wined and dined and everyone told me how great it was going to be. And everyone I met was called vice president. They were all about 23 years old, but they're all vice president commissioning, vice president comedy artifacts, vice president valet services. So all these vice presidents said how good it was going to be. And then And then I realized I was a tiny cog in a huge machine. I went to one meeting. My whole involvement in the project was going to one meeting, which was a meeting to talk about the costumes and the color of the ties that the cast were going to wear. And there were 30 people in the room. And after that meeting, I just thought, this is ridiculous. And the pilot itself was, it wasn't terrible. It was just dull. So despite the fact that all these vice presidents were working on it, in fact, the quality of it wasn't that high. And I thought that was kind of an interesting eye-opener, really, the fact that, you know, you, when you're on the outside and you look in, you think these things are going to be glamorous. And similarly, in, you know, you go through Washington, you see these buildings, the Pentagon, the State Department, they look very imposing. You think the people behind them who work in them know what they're doing. And yet, you know, you walk in, you find out that, you know, in fact, they didn't know what they were doing. I remember reading an account of, I think it was in one of Bob Woodward's books on the behind the scenes in the lead up to Iraq. They were talking about when there were meetings at the White House, when somebody said, so once we've invaded, then what do we do? And of course, no one had really thought that through. And what happened whenever anyone asked that question was everyone else in the room would just bow their heads and stare at the carpet. Like that thing you do at school if you don't know the answer. If you look down, trying to tell yourself that if you can't see the teacher can't see you. And I just thought, that's interesting. They're behaving like kids.
So did you go to Washington yourself and get into the big impressive buildings and try to see what goes on inside?
Yes, I did a couple of above the board meetings with staffers and people who'd worked in the CIA and the Pentagon and the State Department. But I'd also...
How did you set them up? Did you call and say, I'm a filmmaker, I'm doing political satire in which you will be mocked, so please let me come meet with you?
Yeah, more or less, yes. That is the interesting thing. Politicians love it when they are being portrayed in drama and in comedy, and it doesn't really matter how terrible they're being portrayed. The film opens with Malcolm Tucker walking out the front door of number 10 Downing Street. And most often when you're doing that in a film, you have to go to a set. We wrote to number 10 and they said yes, because they were big fans of the television show. So here was this character who was the embodiment of how crass and evil and corrupt politics is, being welcomed into the heart of government. And when we arrived to shoot the scene, all the real Malcolm Tuckers who worked in number 10 had brought their cameras with them because they were all excited. They all wanted to meet Peter Capaldi, who plays Malcolm Tucker, and they all wanted a big team photo with Malcolm and all of them. And similarly, when I was out in Washington, I was speaking to Biden's chief of staff, who was this sort of young, good-looking, really intelligent, quite charismatic guy who was saying, what an exciting job it is that he has, because he meets all these exciting people. And he said, do you know who we had? We had a reception last week. I met Bradley Whitford, who plays Josh in The West Wing. And I'm thinking, but you are Josh. You're the real Josh. Why are you excited to meet an actor who's only a part-time Josh? And it is that thing. I think maybe because the political world is such an enclosed bubble that they are delighted to meet someone from, you know, a real person from outside, onto whom they can offload all their observations about how the system works. So I hooked up with people in Washington, and I was fairly clear. I said, look, I'm not making a documentary. I'm not out to name names. I'm not out to bring anyone down. In many ways, I want to know the dull stuff rather than the juicy stuff. I want
to
know
what time... dull stuff did people tell you that you were?
Well, I want to know what time people get in, what time they go home, who it is they work with, what people are like, and also the little things like, you know, the golden rule in Washington politics is never leave the room, never leave a meeting. If you leave a meeting, you leave power, and that's because big things are decided very, very quickly at meetings, you know, and you could be out of a meeting for 20 minutes, maybe taking a call, and something pretty major was decided when you were gone. And there's no way you can get back into it and try and claim credit for that decision. So Madeleine Albright, when she was Secretary of State, she taught her staff bladder diplomacy, which was basically how to last in a meeting for up to 6 hours without having to go to the bathroom. So it's things like that that makes you realise that, you know, international politics are being conducted on this petty office scale.
So when you were in Washington, you arranged meetings with some people. Did you also arrange to be in places that you weren't supposed to be?
Well, I was intrigued as to what the State Department looked like on the inside, because the film is set a lot in the State Department. And a journalist in Washington said, do you have any kind of BBC pass or anything? And I've got this pass, a BBC pass, and it looks very, very primitive. It is basically just my photo and my name and the words BBC. There's no watermark or serial bar or anything on it. It's just a basic, a child could have put it together. And they said, go up to the reception and say, BBC, I'm here for the 12:30. So I did, and I got in. I got into the State Department, and I thought I'd be escorted with, you know, 50 State Department officials, you know, high security. No, I was just in there on my own, myself and my researcher. And we wandered around the State Department for about half an hour. And I thought, well, let's take some photos, because I need to bring them back to London and to tell the art designer what it looks like. So we were just photographing the inside of the State Department unchallenged. And then this big burly guy came down and just came up to us and went, excuse me. And I said, I'm here for the 12:30. And he said, yeah, it's over there. And just pointed us, and we wandered off. And we ended up at the 12:30, which was a very, very dull press conference given by Condoleezza Rice's press spokesperson. But I was amazed by how easy it was to wander around. Part of me was thinking it was exciting, and another part of me thought, this is technically international espionage we're doing here. I hope I'm not extradited or rendered.
Armando Iannucci, thank you so much for talking with us.
Been a pleasure.
Armando Iannucci wrote and directed the new political satire In the Loop. Contemporary rock fans always like it when they discover an obscure act from the past, which they can point to as a forerunner of what they're into today. The Monks, a band of ex-GIs who achieved notoriety, if not fame, in West Germany in the mid-60s, are a prime example of this. The reissue of their album Black Monk Time, plus the DVD release of the documentary Monks, The Transatlantic Feedback, has put them back in the spotlight. Rock historian Ed Ward tells their story.
Died in Vietnam. James Bond, who is he? Stop it! like the atomic bomb. Stop it! Stop it! I don't like it! Stop it! What's your meaning, Larry? Ah, you think like I think. You're a monk. I'm a monk. We're all monks. Hey, Larry, Eddie, Roger, everybody, let's go. Speed time is hop time. It's monk time now. Yeah! Right!
In 1965, if you were in the Army, there was no better place to be than West Germany, mostly because it wasn't Vietnam. The Torquays knew this. GIs Gary Berger, Larry Clark, Dave Day, Eddie Shaw, and Roger Johnston came together in Gelnhausen, one of those German bases where there wasn't a whole lot to do unless the Russians were invading, and they weren't. The Torquays weren't all that good, but they could play Chuck Berry and surf music, and even better, they could back up singers. They got to tour a bit, and when they mustered out in 1965, they decided to stick together and see if they could make some money. As it turned out, they could. In the wake of the Beatles making Germany famous as a place for rock bands to play, there were jobs all over the place, and the fact that the Torquays were American, not British, was an added advantage. Before long, they were tight enough to be playing Germany's hottest rock scene, Hamburg. And enter the villains, although not everyone sees them like that. Walter Niemann and Karl-Heinz Remy were two former advertising students from German design schools looking for a project where they could put some of the theory they'd studied to use. One night, they walked into a Stuttgart club and heard the Torquays. Having dismissed the Rolling Stones as Baroque and the Beatles as stuff for grandmothers, they realized that in the primitive sound of the Torquays was the clay they could mold to fit their ideas.
Complication! Complication! Constipation!
People cry!
Complication!
Niemann and Remy knew that a visual image was important, so the new anti-Beatles had the tops of their heads shaved, wore robes, and became the monks. The guys in the band weren't too enthusiastic about this at first, but they at least realized that nobody else was doing anything like it. The next thing was lyrics. Instead of love, hate, negation. And the music. A single beat was to pervade all the songs, which was to be keyed to a dance called the hop. These principles were typed on sheets of paper the band had to carry with them at all times, and most important was, you are monks, you are not Torquays. They cut a demo, and it found its way to Jimmy Bovin, a producer at Polydor, one of Germany's largest labels, who was impressed with Niemann and Remy and thought the monks were a historical turning point in pop music. He gave them a contract. In order to get ready to record, the monks hit the road. Audiences hated them. March 1966, they recorded an album, Black Monk Time, with a stark black cover, supposedly influenced by Konstantin Malevich. The band went on German TV when it came out, and the tape is excruciating. The band does its best, but the kids are utterly confused. The monks toured, but audiences remained mostly hostile. More and more, their daily management fell to their tour manager, Wolfgang Gluaschewski, as Niemann and Remy lost interest. Finally, in September 1967, the band called it quits. They returned to America, slammed by culture shock, to which they reacted in different ways. A couple had German wives, but the marriages didn't last. The saddest story was banjoist Dave Day, who returned to Germany with his wife, who left him shortly thereafter. He lived on the streets for a couple of years and refused to talk about it when he finally made it back to the States. The monks remained unknown until they were rediscovered during the punk era, although they had influenced some of the later generation of krautrock musicians. Polydor reissued the album, which didn't sell again. Bassist vocalist Eddie Shaw, who'd become a novelist, wrote a book about the band, and in 1999 they did the first of several reunion gigs. At last they seemed to be enjoying themselves, but they called it quits in 2006. Drummer Roger Johnston died shortly afterwards, and Dave Day died in 2008. The film, The Transatlantic Feedback, plays frequently on cable TV. It's kind of depressing, but it's a window on a very odd time and place, and an extremely odd band.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France. The documentary about the monks is called Monks, The Transatlantic Feedback. Their reissued album is called Black Monk Time. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.